From California to West Virginia, Montana to North Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, America is no longer a constitutional republic. We are now governed by the permanent administrative state. Ned Ryan of American Majority is author of the new book, American Leviathan. He is here to explain. In case you haven't noticed, the federal budget deadline is now just days away, and Congress has yet to pass either a budget or a continuing resolution. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. Mark Cuban has a new project to help lower prescription drug costs. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with him to get the details. And the big loser in the presidential debate was ABC News and its blatantly biased moderators. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. In his new book, American Leviathan, The Birth of the Administrative State and Progressive Authoritarianism, author Ned Ryan makes the case that, regardless of which party holds the White House, the nation is being run by a permanent bureaucracy. He is also the founder and CEO of American Majority. He joins us now for a discussion. Ned, welcome to American Radio Journal. Ned, in your book, you say that over the last 100 years that we've had a slow-moving revolution against the founders and the constitutional republic, all of this moving steadily toward an administrative state. Can you expand a little bit on that statement?
In the early 20th century, the progressive statists, they put in motion the administrative state, which was a complete and total rejection of the founders, specifically on a few fronts. One being, they viewed the Constitution and the machinery of our constitutional republic as more of a bug than a feature because they deeply resented the separation of powers. What they wanted to do was consolidate essentially the executive, legislative, and judicial powers into one entity, the administrative state, which would annihilate the separation of powers that the founders felt was vital to protecting our rights. Progressives wholesale rejected that approach. They were, I call them utopian statists. They believed that the state was salvation. Everything should be subsumed by the state. And they believed that they truly could build a utopia here on earth. So they rejected the realistic optimism of the founders. I call the founders optimistic realists because they were very realistic about human nature. They were optimistic that they could create a rights-based government that would protect our rights and take none of them away. And so what the founders did was establish that, and then what progressives did was actually rejected that beginning of the 20th century, and that's why I call it a regime change, slow-moving revolution against the founders, because over the last 100 years, the progressives have been working steadily towards consolidating power into this administrative state and really truly annihilating the constitutional republic and separation of powers. And I think, honestly, having been in D.C. for almost 25 years, some people want to believe that we are still a constitutional republic, but in reality, we're operating under the progressive governing philosophy.
So we have been moving in this direction now for, as you put it, over about the last 100 years. How is it that Congress in particular, Ned, has abdicated its role, its power to the executive branch?
First of all, the administrative state is deeply unconstitutional, even to the point of, I would say, deeply un-American. It is outside of the American tradition. And Woodrow Wilson, who I call one of the four progressive horsemen, was very honest that he drew his ideas from the Prussian and French models, had nothing to do with the American tradition. But over the course of time, Congress, the Article I branch, has really of its own volition subdelegated its legislating powers to the Article II branch, the executive, where most of the administrative state resides. It kind of was creeping slowly through the 20th century, but I would say a real turning point was late 1960s, where Congress went out and actually created more departments, more agencies, and then handed the power of governance to these unelected bureaucrats inside the administrative state in the executive branch. I would say over the last, we'll call it 50-some years, I would argue that some of the self-governing aspects have really been more of an illusion, because think about what Congress does these days. They pass 4,000 or 5,000 page bills, that really are just kind of a framework that lay out, you know, kind of in general what they expect or hope for. And then they send it to these bureaucrats and they let them frame out in very specific terms how that will look for the everyday American people, for corporations, all of these things, essentially handing to them the power of legislation and governing, which I will add is always what the progressives wanted. They truly believe that the administrators, the bureaucrats, the managerial class should be the ones governing this country. And in fact, the only separation they believed in was separating those administrators out from political accountability, therefore even removing them from accountability to the American people. Because I tell people all the time, elections come and go, right? Administrations come and go. The state always remains. And I think that is very problematic for us trying to get back to a constitutional republic.
Is this one of the reasons why, Ned, if we look at Project 2025, which was a project of the Heritage Foundation, and to be clear, not done by the Trump campaign, not endorsed by the Trump. In fact, the president has disavowed it. The advertising we're seeing here in Pennsylvania, where we are based, the Harris campaign continues to spin falsehoods and lies about that. But if you look at the anger that Project 2025 has engendered from the left, is it because this is a dagger right at the heart of that administrative state?
In some ways, woman, you are correct. It's a shame that Project 2025 has been so problematic for Trump. Again, to state clearly, it's not him. He has nothing to do with it. But the general sense of any ideas that says we will not accept the premise of the administrative state anymore, we reject the premise, we reject the status quo. The people that have been in D.C. that have been a part of that see that as an existential threat. And I tell people, and I've told Trump this to his face, the Russian collusion hoax, the Ukrainian quid pro quo, all of these hoaxes and fantasies and fairy tales that were pushed as real had nothing to do with any of that. It had everything to do with who decides. And Donald Trump, as the great outsider, came into D.C. and said, I'm the duly elected president of the United States. I'm the one who decides both domestic and foreign policy. And they said, we don't think so. So what they were trying to do over the course of really the last, I would argue, 9 years, is destroy someone who they think is a true threat to the administrative state, because they realized, even more so than Donald Trump, I would argue, that a powerful executive who wanted to actually go after the administrative state, since most of it's in the executive branch, could actually do significant damage to it over 4 years in dismantling, devolving, and I would argue destroying it. Because again, Loman, the foundation of the swamp that Donald Trump wants to drain is the administrative state. If you break the state, you can drain the swamp. They know that. And I think Donald Trump, after 4 years and after the last interlude between his first administration, hopefully second, has come to understand, I think he knows what the real problem is the administrative state. And if he can deal with that in a forceful way for 4 years, I think he gives us a real shot of restoring the republic.
We have been talking with Ned Ryan. He is founder and CEO of American Majority, also author of the new book, American Leviathan, The Birth of the Administrative State and Progressive Authoritarianism. Ned, where can folks go if they want to purchase a copy of American Leviathan?
They can go to Amazon pre-order. Comes out September 17th. And in my mind, the book is a conversation starter for people to fully understand this is what's going on in D.C. And the question is, will you accept it? And do we continue down this path? Are you going to fully understand what's going on and reject it? So go to Amazon, pre-order it. And I think people will find it deeply illuminating as to the reality of how D.C. has been operating, quite frankly, for over a century.
And tell us a little bit about American Majority and where can folks go to learn more about American Majority?
AmericanMajority.org is the website, and we've done trainings all over the country, all 50 states, and we're creeping up on getting close to 100,000 people trained to be effective in their local communities and cause that change to take place.
Ned Ryan of American Majority. Ned, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much, Loman.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He has been keeping an eye on maneuvering here. We actually, despite the fact all the attention's been on the debate, and we will get to that, there's actually a federal budget due here in a couple of weeks. A lot of maneuvering there. Scott has the details. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me back.
You are on Capitol Hill today, where Speaker of the House Mike Johnson has pulled a continuing resolution down. What is actually happening here? Are we going to have a continuing resolution? Certainly, I doubt we're going to have any sort of an actual budget.
The appropriations process has been broken for 20 years, and Congress has been usually funded through these omnibus appropriation bills and continuing resolutions. So you might recall that at the end of 2023, we did an omnibus appropriation, and it set higher levels of federal spending and increased our burden when it comes to national debt and deficits. So that spending is scheduled to expire on September 30th. And if you do nothing, then you have what's known as a federal shutdown of unessential services in the federal government. You could see national parks closed. There's a lot of different political maneuvering that always happens during a shutdown. So in order to stave that off and make sure that we don't have a shutdown, you need to pass either your appropriation bills to fund those different agencies and departments in the federal government, or you need to pass what's known as a continuing resolution that funds the federal government at those current levels. For some of those House Republicans this week, funding 6 months of an omnibus that would continue from last year was an unacceptable posture. On the other hand, some of the House conservatives were really pushing for the SAVE Act to be included in the CR. And the SAVE Act is legislation that would have required proof of U.S. citizenship at registration in order to vote. Mike Johnson had the conference meeting, talked through it with members, and he was just a little bit short with the votes. So he pulled that bill down this week and has said that the conversations will be ongoing between the House leadership and its members that are sort of holding out in order to develop some consensus. So it'd be interesting to see if Mike Johnson was able to consolidate a consensus based around lower spending levels, because on one hand, some of these defense hawks want to spend as much money as we can on our national security and national defense, while the fiscal hawks are like, hey, a 1% cut is almost nothing. Why don't we start there? That's one of the pieces of the conversation that's ongoing. The United States Senate is likely to draft its own legislation, which would create a 3-month continuing resolution and fund government probably until Christmas, because they want to create that political appetite for all these anomalies to be funded in a lame duck session, special interest favors for K Street. That's a big, big problem. And I think that's why you see the House Republicans in our majority advocating for a 6-month CR. What's going to happen over the next few weeks will be a really difficult negotiation. You know, I could also see some patchwork being done where they do a 3-week CR or a 1-month CR. But the complicating factor with that is that if they don't fund government, they can't leave Washington. And you've got a lot of House Republicans that are nervous about their own reelection, and same thing for the Democrats. And I think that that's likely to expedite some sort of an agreement where government does not shut down and these folks can concentrate on either helping President Trump or Kamala Harris with the presidential races, serving as surrogates, traveling all over the country, and then also focusing on their own reelection efforts.
Speaking of President Trump and Kamala Harris, of course, we had what may be the one and only presidential debate. We'll see whether or not another one materializes here. So I would be remiss, Scott, if I didn't ask for your thoughts on the debate, particularly as it relates to policy.
Yeah, first of all, I think that Trump's policies are a lot of what people like about him. We know that we were better off 4 years ago than we are today. Inflation is totaled up over 20%, and that's a massive burden on families. And Trump outlined his vision for getting us back to a Trump economy that is fostering an environment of innovation and growth, and that's mostly through deregulation and tax cuts. The Trump tax cuts expire in 2025. Kamala Harris, with the tax increases that she's proposing by supporting the Biden budget, and on top of that, having like a wealth tax and taxing unrealized capital gains, that's a $7 trillion tax increase. It would by far be the largest tax increase in our nation's history. So there's a real difference between the candidates when it comes to their handling of the economy. Of course, the Biden regime has been manipulating data, and they want to say that they've created more jobs than any administration in our nation's history. The fact of the matter is that those were jobs that went away during COVID, and through the draconian policies that our nation faced during a terrible time. And they've done nothing really to foster an environment of economic activity that increases productivity and increases wages and really has those macroeconomic growth effects that we need to see to really improve the middle class. And ultimately, when you have a smaller government that allows people to be free and innovate and to invest and reinvest, that's going to give you the kind of growth that I think will improve the lives of all people in all communities. And there was data that came out following the debate that I think came from the New York Times and Reuters, and it said that people trust Donald Trump on the economy more than they trust Kamala Harris. Digging in deeper, Lohman, people that are undecided, not independent, not Republican, not Democrat, but people that were termed undecided believe that Donald Trump will do a better job handling the economy as well. The economy is the number one issue in America. Illegal immigration is number two. And Democrats want to try to make this about other issues like January 6th or abortion. And I think that the American people are smarter than that. They're going to vote in the best interest of their pocketbook. And we're going to vote to reelect Donald Trump.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club, please.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're united in those ideas of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. If you want to check us out, visit clubforgrowth.org. And let me give a shout out to my friends Bernie and Janie listening today.
Sounds good there, Scott. Appreciate it. Live from Capitol Hill, Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
It is called Costs Plus Drugs, a new program designed to lower prescription drug costs. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details now from Mark Cuban.
Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Every week here on American Radio Journal, I bring you news and interviews from things going on in politics and around the rest of the country. But my main gig is working for Reason Magazine as a reporter and podcaster. My podcast is called Why We Can't Have Nice Things, and the new season of it is out now. We start off with an interview with Mark Cuban from Shark Tank and the co-owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks. And I talked with him about something called Cost Plus Drugs, which is a new project of his that's aiming to bring down the cost of pharmaceutical drugs. I think it's an interesting project. I think it's an important project. And I think our conversation about that and about kind of the problems in America's pharmaceutical system and pharmaceutical industry is something that you might be interested in hearing. So I'm going to play for you the first few minutes of that podcast, and I hope you'll enjoy. What's wrong with American healthcare? We're the richest country on the planet. We live in an age of incredible scientific breakthroughs that mean people live longer, healthier lives. We have the best medical schools, the best physicians, the best tech. But ask someone about their most recent trip to the doctor or the hospital, and you'll probably hear a groan and then a few complaints. So, really, what's wrong here? I'm Eric Boehm, and this is season two of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, a Reason Magazine podcast series. You'll often hear that the problem with American healthcare is essentially the profit motive, that drug companies and hospitals and so on are more interested in their bottom lines than in taking care of patients or providing affordable services. Healthcare is a right, people like to say. Healthcare is a public good. Something about that logic has just never quite made sense to me. I mean, any successful business has to balance its bottom line with the needs and wants of its customers. Is healthcare more of a right than food? Yes, you might argue that healthcare is a bit different than some other markets, but I'm not sure that it really is. Everywhere else, free market capitalism encourages innovation and competition. Better products, better services, lower prices tend to win. But healthcare costs keep going up, and almost no one seems to be happy with the services they're getting. In a Gallup poll taken last year, just 10% of Americans said healthcare in the U.S. was excellent. So yeah, what's wrong here? That's the question that was driving me when we launched into the new season of this podcast. And from the start, I felt like we wouldn't find the answer in Washington, D.C., so I spent the past few months talking to some of the people who deal with this stuff every day, like a midwife in Georgia.
They were interested in blocking us at whatever the cost.
An eye surgeon in North Carolina.
It is a very pernicious law that seems very small and ineffectual on the surface, but that infiltrates every aspect of healthcare.
A cancer specialist in Massachusetts.
Physicians are confused and you know, our ethical obligations are in direct conflict with the law.
And some of the lawyers and activists who are working to improve the healthcare system for patients and doctors. I came away from those conversations with the sense that America's healthcare system is nothing like a free market, and the only capitalism is often of the crony variety, with special interests lobbying for special treatment from the government. So on this new season of Why We Can't Have Nice Things, we're covering a series of stories about how the government is making Americans sicker and poorer. We've dug deep into the laws and regulations that are restricting doctors' ability to treat patients and patients' ability to get needed treatments. And hopefully we'll offer a few solutions to those problems too. In fact, I thought we would kick things off by talking to a guy who is trying to provide one of those solutions. Someone who is trying to inject a little bit of entrepreneurial capitalism into the pharmaceutical drug industry.
My name is Mark Cuban. I'm an investor, an entrepreneur, and co-founder of Cost Plus Drugs.
Now, you know Mark from his long-running TV show Shark Tank, as well as being the co-owner of the NBA's Dallas Mavericks. His latest major venture is Cost Plus Drugs, launched in 2022. It's a website where consumers can buy generic pharmaceutical drugs at transparent prices and get the drugs mailed directly to their door, bypassing the middlemen that are typically involved when dealing with pharmacies and insurance plans.
Drug prices are rising twice as fast as the rate of inflation.
And that has people making some dangerous decisions.
So if you were a contestant on Shark Tank with this idea with Cost Plus Drugs, how would you pitch it? Like, what's the elevator pitch for what it is that you're doing?
The elevator pitch is really simple. Who do you trust within the medical supply chain? Your doctor? Do you think the healthcare system is run properly? And if I could show you a business where you could trust it because everything was transparent, would you be more likely to use it? And if I could show you this business and show that I saved you money on your medications, would you be willing to tell others? It was really obvious to me that if you were taking imatinib, a cancer drug, and you were paying $800, $1,000, $2,000, and we were selling it for $30, not only would you buy from us, but you tell your doctor and you tell everybody in your Facebook, you know, support group that has the same disease to do the same thing. And that's exactly what's happened.
Cost Plus Drugs shouldn't seem like a revolutionary thing. It operates the same way that so much of the modern world does. It's consumer friendly, easily accessible, and fast.
You go to costplusdrugs.com, you put in the name of the medication, it tells you where your doctor should send the script, tells you how much it costs, and then boom, we fill it.
We'll talk to Mark a bit more about Cost Plus Drugs and the business model later in this episode, but I want to cut right to the chase here. Obviously, a big part of his sales pitch is lower prices. So that leads to an obvious question, one that comes up quite a bit whenever politicians start talking about healthcare policy. Why are drug prices in America so high?
Drug prices in this country are so high because there is zero transparency in the system. And when there's zero transparency in a market, there is no way for it to be efficient. When it's inefficient, people learn very quickly how to take advantage of those inefficiencies to their own profit. And that's exactly what's happened in the healthcare and pharmacy sector.
Thanks for listening. That is only the beginning of our long conversation with Mark Cuban. You can check that out at reason.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The rest of the season will be rolling out through this month and next month as well. We're going to tackle a variety of topics connected to healthcare, including certificate of need laws, including problems with America's organ donation system that leave people in need of kidneys without the ability to get one, and a variety of other interesting and I think fascinating topics. So check all of that out, if you will, at reason.com, and catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The era of yellow journalism has returned and was on full display in the presidential debate as the moderators came to the rescue of one of the candidates. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Of all the articles I've read since Tuesday night's debate between former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris, and I've read a ton of them, the best one so far has been Roger Kimball's piece in The Spectator. Instead of focusing on the sparring match between the two candidates and opining on who won and why, Kimball saw an even more troubling issue on screen from the National Constitution Center. The biggest loser was the once proud profession of journalism. A century and a half ago, journalism had a tarnished reputation and was justifiably held in low esteem. The standards of truth and style that the great publishers of the 18th century in both America and Britain had deteriorated. Benjamin Franklin's Gazette and the original New York Post had closed. The New York Times was just a startup. Publishers found that sensationalism sold papers more effectively then Straight News. Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst competed for public attention with exaggerated headlines and general disregard for the truth. Their goal was to incite and inflame, not to inform. It came to be known as the era of yellow journalism. But just as many stage comedians yearn to be taken more seriously as Shakespearean actors, so the business of journalism began to clean itself up. Standards were established. Schools of journalism, like the University of Missouri School of Journalism and the Columbia University School of Journalism, were established to position journalism as a profession, just as law and medicine were considered professions. Journalism schools provided training and created standards. Journalism claimed that it upheld democracy by providing the information people need to be free and self-governing. That's a lofty and noble goal, and although a certain amount of media bias has always and inevitably been present, journalism was held in generally high esteem. Remember when Walter Cronkite was called the man whom America trusts? That's gone now. The twin phenomena of 24-hour cable TV news channels targeted to certain ideologies, plus social media becoming a primary news source for many, have put us back on the road to yellow journalism. Tuesday night's presidential debate on ABC demonstrated that indelibly. The title and subtitle of Roger Kimball's article in The Spectator were, "ABC News is the Big Loser of the Trump-Harris Debate." David Muir and Lindsay Davis repeatedly pecked at one candidate and not the other. He then provided these examples. The evening was supposed to offer Kamala Harris and Donald Trump an opportunity to present themselves to the public and explain their positions on various policy matters that are important to the public. Instead, it was an event in which David Muir and Lindsay Davis repeatedly pecked at and corrected, or pretended to correct, one candidate, Donald Trump, while passing over lie after lie emitted by Kamala Harris. Trump did not say there were fine people on both sides at Charlottesville. He did not incite a resurrection on January 6th. He has not proposed instituting a nationwide ban on abortion. His tax cuts are not a tax cut for billionaires. He did not say there would be a bloodbath if he lost the election. He has not threatened to weaponize the DOJ to go after his political opponents. On the contrary, he has suffered from that very process, overseen and egged on by the Biden-Harris administration. Kimball's piece ends with this. I'm not sure there was a clear winner in Tuesday's debate. There was, however, a clear loser, and that was ABC News, which, thanks to the performance of Muir and especially Davis, demonstrated once and for all that ABC is just a partisan propaganda machine in the pocket of the anti-Trump lobby. The lopsidedness of the moderation of that debate is the best rationale for a second debate, and the Fox News Channel is the proper host. They can either balance the scale with an equally partisan favoritism on the other side, or they can provide an example of how journalism should operate as a legitimate profession in the service of the public by asking follow-up questions and refusing to tolerate non-answers. Either approach would be better than the debacle we witnessed on ABC on Tuesday night. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WEEU-AM in Reading, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Keystone State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.